I first interviewed Jennifer Allen on November 17th of 2013. I did not know her personally prior to the interview, but we share a number of mutual friends. As a ceramic artist and web surfer, I've enjoyed Jennifer's blog, and in particular, her Potter of the Month feature. I deeply appreciate her commitment to function and the table in her studio work. Her handles are comfortable and her surfaces are full of subtle depth. She earned her BFA at the University of Alaska Anchorage and her MFA from Indiana University in Bloomington. She currently lives and works in Morgantown, West Virginia, where she also teaches at West Virginia University. I invite you to learn more about Jennifer by visiting her website, www.jenniferallenceramics.com. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. So first off, can you give us a little background on yourself? Where did you go to school? Any highlights in your ceramic path prior to your current position? How long have you been with West Virginia?
Yeah, so I started, I did my undergraduate school at University of Alaska Anchorage, and it took me about, 6 years to graduate from that program.
Okay.
And then after that, I worked for a potter full-time for a year, and then I did a post-bac studies for a year at Rochester Institute of Technology, the School for American Crafts. And after that, I went to the Archie Bray Foundation for a summer. And then I went to graduate school at Indiana University. Then I went back to the Archie Bray Foundation for 2 years, the residency for 2 years. And then I came to West Virginia University. So that span of time was from 95 to 2008.
Okay.
In 2008, I finally got to West Virginia University. So I started undergrad in 95, wound up in West Virginia in 2008.
Okay.
And I've been teaching part-time in West Virginia, and I started teaching drawing classes, not ceramics classes, and just one class a semester, and then they bumped me up to two a semester. And now I'm teaching two ceramics classes a semester.
If I'm correct, both you and your husband work in clay and also work for West Virginia?
Yes. My husband is the head of ceramics at West Virginia University.
Okay. Do you feel that having a spouse who works in ceramics makes it easier or more difficult as a mother trying to balance studio life, parenting, and teaching?
Oh, my gosh. Well, gosh, it's so tough. I mean, I guess in some ways they're understanding because they know the process and what it takes to work with clay, but he's really supportive, and I think it's because he does know the process. Like, I know I've got friends who, you know, one of them is in some other position that's not creative at all.
Mm-hmm.
They have different struggles. And one of them, they say, is, well, they just don't understand what it takes to make things, like the timing involved and all that stuff. I guess in some ways it's easier, if I was going to answer that plainly. Only because of the process and him understanding what it takes.
In your questionnaire, you mentioned that your studio is at home. Uh-huh. Can you talk a bit about this setup and the advantages or disadvantages that come with this arrangement? And how does this studio location impact your relations to family life and children?
You know, I haven't had a lot of time to work in the studio, but my arrangement is that I have a basement studio that has wheels, a kiln, a small electric kiln, and it's about 300 square feet total.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the space is adequate, but it is cold in the basement and wet and all of those things. And there's not a lot of light in the studio, which is, you know, sometimes difficult, especially in the winter. It being close to the living space though is great because, especially as far as timing's concerned, because I can like get to a certain point and then be, okay, well, I need to run up and make dinner really quick. And I could go make dinner and then I can come back down and cover up the piece, or, you know, it's time to put a handle on then on a mug, or, you know, so in that way, I guess the timing's easier instead of having to drive back and forth to a studio. The other thing that is really advantageous for us is that our daycare is right next door. We have a woman next door who runs daycare out of her home. So it's easy if I need a day in the studio, I can, you know, take her over there and just kind of work all day in the studio. And if I miss her or if I'm worried about her or anything, because she's my first kid, I can run over and visit and say hello. Or if I wanted to nurse or something like that. That's really convenient. But I think I only answered part of that question. What was the second part?
How does this studio location impact your relations to family life and children, which I think is kind of interwoven into the advantages, disadvantages?
Yes, yeah. You know, part of it is, you know, sometimes I worry, like, I'm kind of a safety nut, and I worry about, like, things like silicosis and stuff like that.
Sure.
Having a studio in the home environment. And so my kid does not come down to my studio at all. I do keep it really clean, but not only is it dusty, but it's also cold and damp. And I just don't think it's a good place for her to be yet. You know, certainly I want her to play around on the wheel and play with clay and stuff like that. But I'm waiting a little bit longer before that happens. It's nice because of a timing issue. It's also bad because I feel like I'm always attached to work. You know, like my work is always right there. And so in that way, it's bad. There's not really a separation so much from work and home life. Like, I feel like even if I had a studio in the backyard, you know, in a detached garage or something like that, then that would be different because there would be some kind of, I mean, of course, physical or literal separation, but also just the feeling of it being, you know, that's where I work. That's the work environment, and that's the home environment.
Right.
Where right now it's, you know, in one, under one roof.
Do you have any hopes for changing that or plans?
I do, yeah. We've talked a lot about, you know, we bought a starter home because
mm-hmm.
we just kind of wanted to get someplace and settled. And we didn't anticipate being here for the rest of our lives, but we do have a nice piece of land, so we could stay and expand the house, build onto the house. We've been talking about building a detached kind of garage thing
mm-hmm.
In the backyard that would be a studio. We live a little bit outside of the city, not far, like a mile.
Okay.
And so we have, you know, a considerable amount of land than if we were to live in the city of Morgantown. I mean, ideally, I would like to have a separate space, and he would, too. That's like even just a one-car garage kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on to the next one. In your questionnaire, you talked about being able to work in the studio when your spouse could watch your child or after she goes to bed, and that you have that occasional child care next door. Is this still your current arrangement, or has it changed at all?
Still the same.
Okay. So going back to those first few days, months, years after the birth of your child, and then in your podcast interview I listened to you with Brian Jones.
Oh, geez.
I did my research.
Yeah.
You mentioned going back to teaching after 2 weeks. How difficult was this, and why did you choose to go back so quickly, and how did it work with such a young baby?
Yeah, well, it wasn't very smart in retrospect, but I'm just hired on as an adjunct, so
sure.
I don't get any kind of maternity leave.
Right.
Right. And I had grad students watching my classes. I felt guilty. I wanted to be there to give them the education that I wanted to give them.
Yep.
Not that the grad students weren't doing a good job. I don't want to say that, because they were. I mean, they did fine, but I guess I'm a little bit of a control freak, my husband says. So relinquishing that control and not being there to teach my students was hard. So I did go back after 2 weeks. With Annalise, luckily my husband was around to watch her. And my classes that I taught were both the same day. So it was Monday and Wednesday. And one was a morning class and one was a night class. So
okay.
It wasn't like I was gone for, you know, a 6 hour chunk at a time. It was just 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours at night.
Okay.
So my nursing wasn't interrupted that much. I think if my classes were back to back, it would have been a lot harder. You know, I mean, I guess we just did it. We had to make it work. We knew before the schedule for the spring semester was set, because I'm semester to semester hired, you know?
Yep.
We knew, of course, that I was pregnant, because of our finances, I need to work too.
Sure.
I can't make enough on just my work. So we knew that it was going to happen. We knew that I wasn't going to get maternity leave, but that I needed to have those classes so that I could afford to live, you know, paying back my student loans and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we just made it work.
And so when was she born?
She was born the 26th of January.
Okay.
Yeah. She was born on a, I guess it was a Friday night, I think. It might have been a Saturday. I can't really remember. It was all a blur. I think it was a Friday night my water broke, and Saturday she came. That was convenient because it was, you know, a weekend. Yep. So I could teach my classes the week before. But she did come 2 weeks early, which was a shock.
Oh, wow.
Because the day before the night that my water broke, I was in my studio busily trying to make as much bisqueware as I could, you know, as much greenware. So there I am, got all this clay wedge ready for the next day of throwing. And I had made all these, you know, mugs, which is probably why she came early, because I was like way overdoing it. But it also happened to be a full moon that night.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to get everything set so that when she came, I could just concentrate on glazing work, which requires a lot less timing, right?
Yeah.
So that was the plan. And I did get a lot made ahead of time. But when we did come home, my mom came like 2 days after. She lives in Portland, Oregon. So she flew in, I think, when my daughter was 3 days old. And I was like, Mom, I need to get just a couple hours in the studio just to finish the work that I've started because I don't want it to go bad. So here I am, totally sleep deprived, right? And the first 2 weeks of the kid being born, down there working in my studio, putting handles on mugs.
So back in those first few days, yeah. Or months after the birth of your child, can you reflect on your feelings towards your studio practice at that point in time? And you've kind of tipped on it a little bit.
Well, I think even before my kid came, I felt like my work needed to change. But now, because I've had that time to really reflect on my work and what it is now, or what it was then, rather, and wanting something different out of it. I mean, it's just like the kid's here now. It feels like a new chapter in my life. I feel like my work also needs to reflect that a little bit. And it needs to change, too. I don't know if I really answered that, but...
It makes complete sense. So there are two common responses that women made in relation to their studio practices in the questions I gave out. And it was pretty much across the board. Everybody made one or both of these statements. And the first one was, I often make bad decisions when working after the kids have gone to bed, or I make more work than I can finish the following day, or I mess up the work I made earlier in the day. And the second one was that I'm much more efficient or effective with my time that I do have when I go to the studio. These two, you know, both of being really being more effective with what time I do have, and I make bad decisions late at night. Why do you think these are such common statements from all of us?
I feel like now all of our time, like our day is scheduled, right? And it's all scheduled around the kid. And so there's these small windows of opportunity for you to be able to work on your own stuff that late at night after the kid goes to bed, you're exhausted already, right? And so yet bad decisions can happen. And I think for me, I'm such a planner and I want to make sure that everything's kind of accounted for before I even step in the studio door. So my 1 hour, one day of studio time would be to set up the studio for the next day of work.
Sure.
You know, so I would just go down there and wedge clay, clean the throwing bucket, clean the wheel, so that the next day when I went down, I could be productive. It's because, you know, anymore, you don't have that on a whim being able to go to the studio or just kind of let the creative thing and the creative mind and the creative process take its course. Instead, you're forced into a very specific time where you have to make all that happen. If you're not in the creative zone and you're going into your studio, then bad decisions could happen, right?
Yep.
And that makes complete sense. And also the whole efficiency thing, I mean, that's just, that's just how I responded, because that's how I work.
So I thought that was kind of, I mean, it's something that I hadn't really, you know, taken into my whole thinking until we had that conversation. But I do find it kind of intriguing that everybody feels like I'm, you know, my studio time is much more precious and important and valued. Yeah. When you were talking about your work with Brian Jones in the podcast, you stated that there was less time to work and that thus it made it a little bit more difficult to see changes in your artwork. And you talked about feeling like you ought to make bigger changes in the work in order to see growth happen yeah. kind of on the time frame you were thinking. And in your questionnaire, you mentioned experimenting with forms and a more monochromatic palette. Can yeah. you talk a bit about where you are currently in your studio in relation to these two ideas?
The biggest changes I've made is I've started making pots that have no decoration on them, that just have texture that relates to kind of these ideas of sewing that I like to deal with my work. So that's one major change, and those are monochromatic. And then the other thing is that I've been doing, instead of applying all the decoration at the glazing stage, I've been doing a lot of carving into the pieces now, and it's not as complicated as doing all the drawing at the glaze stage. And with that, those pieces too, they're more just white and celadon glazes, so none of this very bright, vivid color. And so that's kind of where I'm at. I haven't experimented too much with different forms, I guess just the surface qualities of the forms, so and the color. So whether it's more texture or less color, I guess. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense, yep.
Okay.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
I think it's always exciting when something new happens in your studio, even if it's not totally resolved, it's still exciting to, you know, get a spark.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I find, like, a lot of stuff when I, you know, this my stuff in the past, one of the things that really triggered me wanting to make a change is hearing feedback from a lot of people about how they would never use my plates, for instance, because of all the decoration on the surface of the plate.
Oh.
And thinking about it and reflecting, like, in my own home, which ones I use all the time for my meals. And I do have a couple of my plates that I use, but I typically only use those plates for either cheese and crackers or dessert. Okay. I wouldn't use them to serve a steak dinner or something more complex like that. And it has a lot to do with the influence of not only the pattern, but the color, mainly the color, you know, and it not complementing the food as much. And so, and a lot of the pieces that I eat off of are Tara Wilson plates, you know, very simple wood-fired pieces, or, you know, all celadon or all white or all, yes. So it's just interesting. And I have a very few patterned plates. And I want my work to be used, you know, and so that's kind of the driving force behind the change that I want to make, too.
That's a really interesting, I mean, I was thinking, gosh, your plates need to come up here to, like, a left of dinner.
Yeah.
Where it's, like, the all-white meal.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, your people are here in Minnesota. Because every time I've been to a couple of those dinners because I work for a Norwegian Lutheran college. And so it cracks me up because, you know, I always think, God, can't I serve this off of something other than a white plate?
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty. But I think that's a really good point because now it makes me think, like, what are the ones that get used the most in our house? And it's funny because I think some of them are color-based, but some of them are also, it's size. You know, it's like the perfect, it's the perfect size for this or for that. But I think lately Randy Johnston plates in our house are a big use. And then I've got a great little plate from Deb Schwarzkopf, which is like the perfect kind of sandwich size.
Yes, yeah.
But that's a good point to think about with that, because we do have one. I have one of Sarah Yeager's plates,
mm-hmm.
and yep. yeah, but yep. it's also kind of like a more like a dessert plate or, you know, like
so a smaller one.
Yeah. Scone size, you know?
Yes.
So
yeah, I have a couple of hers too. I've got some small ones and some big ones, and the small one is like her black with the green decoration on
yep.
it. Yeah. And that one I use for desserts. Yeah. I don't use it for a lot of stuff, but the big ones I do. However, you know her palette that's yellow and
yes,
and blue? Yeah. I have a big dinner plate of hers of that, and I hardly ever use it. But the Temaku and green dinner plate of hers, I use all the time.
See, the one we've got is like blue, green, red, white.
Yes,
you know,
okay,
like
yeah.
pizzazz. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to think about, because I'm trying to think if there were, there are any others that, I think the, we have a Linda, a really nice Linda Christensen plate, and that one gets a lot of play.
Yeah, that's, we have got a lot of her pots. I love her pots, and we use them all the time.
So in your questionnaire, you mentioned two things that stuck out. You mentioned that your studio practice seems a lot less important, and that you commit to a lot less in, and this is also coming from that podcast, and that ability to say no is much easier. Can you talk about this new kind, found kind of confidence and that ability to prioritize?
You know, I feel like now my baby is the most important thing in my life, right?
Sure.
So I guess it's not, so my career's taken a little bit of a back seat. Oh, let's see. Can you ask me that question one more time?
Sure. So in the questionnaire, you mentioned two things that stuck out. You mentioned that your studio practice seems a lot less important, and that you commit to a lot less. In the podcast, you also talk about the ability to say no being much easier.
Yes. I feel like again, because my honey, baby girl, you go hang out with Dada. She's getting so tired. Sorry, Kate. Let me hand her off to the dad. Hang on. There goes the dad. I think she needs her diaper change. To the dad. So I guess as far as like saying no to more things, I think that, you know, I get asked to do a lot of small shows, and I, before, I wanted to do all of them because I really wanted my work to be visible. I was worried about pushing my career, and the more visible I was, you know, I felt like I was more successful. And now that's not as important. So now it's choosing the ones that I feel I can manage. Like if somebody comes to me with something 3 months away, I'll probably say no. But if somebody says I've got something that's 6 months out or a year out, then I could say yes to something like that. And that's because I don't have as much studio time, so I need to give myself enough of a window to be able to make even those 3 to 5 pieces that I want to put, you know, 3 to 5 really quality pieces that I want to put in a show. I'm not in a lot of galleries anymore, and my work's not going to be in the Northern Clay Center anymore. And I think that all of those things are going to be really good for me, because then I can focus on these changes that I want to make with my work too.
Sure.
And not feel like the whole world is seeing the changes as they happen. So I can come up with another body of work that I'm really happy with and start saying yes again to things.
Oh, that makes complete sense. I think that's really smart.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. You know, I've done it the other way too. Like I was really dumb when I was in graduate school and I showed my work in galleries in graduate school because galleries wanted it. And then my work changed so fast, you know, because I'm in graduate school and it's changing like daily. By the end of grad school, some of the galleries were like, whoa, we don't know what's going on. We don't want your work anymore. And so I've kind of done it that way. So experience tells me that maybe it would be smart to do it this way now. Take a step back. I mean, the choice to be in Northern Clay Center, not to be in Northern Clay Center anymore, wasn't really mine, but I also couldn't fill the demands anymore either.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't keep sending them a ton of work at the holiday show, and they have a bunch of work that's really old of mine that I'm glad they sent some of it back. Yeah, and it's easy if I get an invitation to be in a cup show and to put one cup in, you know, it's easy for me to say, you know what, I don't think I can do this cup show this time. You know, whereas before I would have been really into it. But I think about the time it takes, I mean, not making the cup so much, but the time and the cost of shipping one cup to a show and what kind of money I get back out of that cup, you know, it's just not cost effective. And if I was still trying to build my career a little bit more, then I would keep saying yes. But I feel like I'm at an okay spot right now that I don't need to do that anymore. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, yep.
I know I kind of went all around that question, but
that's okay.
Okay.
Sometimes a circle answers it perfectly, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so this brings us to kind of a big question about ceramics, career paths, and family. What do you think that we can do in the clay community to prevent making women feel that they must choose from maternity or a career?
That is a big question. Gosh, you know, it's so interesting because I still remember one of my former professors saying, she's somebody who's, you know, got this crazy dynamite career in ceramics. And she told me once, she had a fellow classmate in grad school who wound up having kids right out of grad school. And she didn't. And she said, and this guy contacted her and said how impressed and how envious he was of her career and how much recognition she's gotten and all this stuff. And she said, yeah, but you have a family, and how she was so envious of that. And so it is interesting that there is kind of this divide and this choice that you have to make. And I feel, you know, one of my really good friends from undergraduate school is Deborah Schwarzkopf, and she's like dynamite all over the scene, but she has no kids yet. And so she has that time to commit to marketing and doing all these things, and she does them all really well. And I often think about what would happen if I was in her shoes, and I don't know. It's interesting that there is kind of this choice that has to be made, because the moms that I know don't have as much time to make work. But they're making really good work, you know. I don't know what we can do I don't know. That's a tough question. I do not have an answer for it.
That's okay, too. I mean, I don't know that anybody has the answer. But I think even just posing the question and asking people to think about even, you know, kind of the way we've set up our programming with schools or with residencies or what have you, that, you know, sometimes if we're just aware of the fact that a lot of those opportunities are really awesome and they're a lot easier to take, because it's just a lot easier to pick up and go someplace when you don't have a family than it is, you know, if you wanted to pick up and go someplace, you know, for a year, it's really difficult if you have a mortgage and a child, and then even bigger is if they're in school, you know, and all of that. And so even just kind of posing the question to people of how can we still make opportunities available in ways, or how can we change the way we look at opportunities, or even for some of us, how do you change the way that you look at success or what, you know, a career is? Because sometimes it's not the kind of path, but just changing the way you look at that path that makes it all kind of make sense too.
I never really thought about it because I never was on this side of things like I am now. And maybe that's part of the discussion that needs to happen, you know.
What advice do you have for young women working in the ceramics field as they begin to think, or not, about their future as mothers and makers?
You know, I think the piece of advice that was offered to me that was really helpful, I guess it's more technical than anything, but just in order to be prepared for when that kid comes, just make as much work as you can before it arrives so that you can do all the finishing afterwards. You know? So like how I said, I was trying to get as much bisqueware together as I possibly could so that I could finish it later. But, you know, having a kid, there's never the right time to have a kid. So I don't think that I wouldn't recommend somebody like putting off having a kid until like their career is somewhere where they want it to be, because they always can chip away at that after the kid comes. And you know, sometimes kids are a surprise. You don't know that they're going to happen, and they do. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I would just say to just take one day at a time. And, I mean, to think about that future, but to really live in the present, you know, and to really be present for things. That's a tough one.
So who are the biggest role models for you when it comes to successful women in clay who are also mothers, and what have you gained from these women?
Well, I think Carrie Radash, Erin Ferensky, Beth Robinson, Lisa Orr. Jess Parker is somebody that just, I mean, she doesn't have that much of a career in clay anymore, I don't think. She might still be on the board for the Archie Bray Foundation, but her career has changed. It's not so much about making work anymore as it is advocating for ceramics. And for her, I just remember she had twins. And when I had my daughter and thinking about the time that it took me to do things and thinking about her with twins, I was just like, I don't know how the heck she did anything, how she was alive, you know? It's like, so I have all the respect in the world for that woman. I don't know. I think that they all, and Carrie and even Erin, their work has changed a lot since they've had kids, I feel. Maybe not really fast, but you definitely can see changes, subtle changes in their work. I'm just really impressed that they can make as much as they make, how visible they still are with their work and their career and all those kinds of things. So that's pretty impressive. And also how visible some of them are, like Carrie, how active she is in social media and how she's kind of staying on top of marketing, being able to market her brand. Yeah. Oh, and Linda Christensen, there's another one. I don't know, you know, there's just so many.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more information or to listen to additional interviews like the one you just heard, please visit www.bothartistandmother.com. Funding for this project was made possible by St. Olaf College's Academic Innovation Fund. Special thanks to Caleb Ganheimer for his audio editing, the Ericksons for their music, Heather Wang for her transcription skills, Rachel Elizabeth Murphy for her web expertise, and to all the artist mothers. Thank you.